We are kicking off a new sermon series called One Hit Wonders. So please stay seated as we welcome rock star Lenny to the platform.
It's about to start here.
In the jungle, the mighty jungle, the lion sleeps tonight.
Yeah, you guys know it. You know it.
In the jungle, the quiet jungle, the lion.
Okay, you can start to fade it down. They got the gist. I do want to welcome you to this new sermon series called The One Hit Wonders. Shane, last week, he kind of introduced it, and he just kind of left it there. In fact, the person sitting next to me was trying to figure out, what is that? What's the one-hit wonders? And he was trying to guess, and he was way off. I will give you the clue right now. This is what it is. Over the next 5 weeks, we will be taking a look at the five books of the Bible that have only one chapter. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's what it is. And each week, we will have a different one-hit wonder song. We'll have our own little walk-up song that we can come up to. I chose this one, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, for mine. Partly, if you were to go into my office, you would see lions everywhere. They are all over the place. And if you would try to count them, many of you would come up with different numbers because they are all over, and there's many, and you might lose count, and you will miss some because they're in nooks and crannies, and they're all over the place. But that's when The Lion Sleeps Tonight was made famous for us by the Tokens back in 1961. But that's not when it was written. It was written in 1939 by a guy in South Africa by the name of Solomon Linda, and he had like an a cappella group called the Evening Birds, and he named the song Mbube or something like that. Eventually, he gave rights to, over here in America, to one of the recording studios. Somebody else sang it, but then the Tokens in 1961 made it popular. And then it was like on the top of the charts for about 3 weeks. And then it was popularized again when The Lion King came out back in the 90s. And so, you know, different generations, that song has just been well known. But I couldn't tell you anything else that the Tokens have sung, other than that, this one-hit wonder. Our first one-hit wonder is Obadiah. Obadiah, that's in the Old Testament. I am guessing that many of you, most of you, probably have not heard a sermon out of Obadiah. In fact, some of you are going, who is Obadiah and where is that at? Well, I can tell you, it's towards the end of the Old Testament. It's in what is called the Minor Prophets, and it comes between Amos and Jonah. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah. Yeah, it's right in there. So you'll be able to find it. And as you are looking up that, I'm going to give you just a moment. But here's another clue about the next ones. All the next four are in the New Testament. This is the only Old Testament book that's one chapter. I'm going to read some out of the book of Obadiah. I'm not going to read all 21 verses, but I'm going to start verses 1 through 4, jump down to verse 10, and then we'll finish out at verse 18. The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We've heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, arise, let us go against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks, in the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, who can bring me down to earth? And though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If jump over to verse 10. Because of violence to your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame, and you will be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, don't boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster. Do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. And don't stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives. And do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. For the day of the Lord draws near on all the nations. And as you have done, it will be done to you. And your dealings will return on your own head. And skip over to 18. The house of Jacob will be a fire, the house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau will be as stubble. And they will set them on fire and consume them so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau. Obadiah starts out this way. The vision of Obadiah, thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We don't really know who Obadiah is. There's a few Obadiahs in the Bible, but most people don't think that it's one of those guys. Like many names, there are several names and people. It was probably written somewhere between the 800s and the late 500s BC. But many, you know, some have it earlier based on some things that they read in here and from other aspects of that are in the Old Testament. Some think it's later because of things that they read in here and what they've read in other places. So we don't really exactly know who and exactly when. We just kind of know the time frame. And most of the prophets usually spoke to the nations of Israel and Judah, the sister countries, all sons of Jacob, Judah and Israel, except Obadiah and Nahum and Jonah. Nahum spoke about the Assyrian nation. Jonah did too, although specifically the city of Nineveh. And here's Obadiah speaking precisely really about Edom. And the question may be asked, who are the Edomites? Something I read might give you a clue earlier, what came a little bit later. It talks about Edom here, and then it says Esau. The Edomites were the descendants of Esau. And most of you will probably know, okay, I know who Esau is. Some of you may not. But Esau was Jacob's twin brother. Obadiah's message through this really is the doom of Edom. God is writing through the prophet and basically saying to Edom, okay, I know your deeds. I know what you've done. And because of that, here's what's going to happen. You're going to basically go away, kind of in a nutshell. And so he kind of starts out giving this part of it. Your prideful arrogance is going to be part of your doom. And here's the reason why. Here's what you've done. Your prejudiced actions against your brother nation, what you have done is going to be the very downfall of yours. And how did it start? How did they get to this part where God is saying to this particular nation, hey, we're going to wipe you out? Well, it all started back at the birth, really. Jacob and Esau, twin brothers. Now, most twins that I have known, you know, if they're identical, they look alike. But most twins I know, they kind of think alike and they get along. Jacob and Esau did not. And it all kind of really started at the birth. Now, Jake and then Shane talked about Abraham's story the last couple of weeks. You know, Abraham and Sarah couldn't have a kid, and finally, at the age of 100, Isaac was born. Well, Isaac grows up, marries Rebekah, and like mom and dad, they too are barren and can't have children. Eventually, God speaks to Rebecca and says, you know what, you're going to have twins, but the older will serve the younger. And that's kind of what happened. And Mama is part of the problem in this problem with the two brothers. For you see, when they're born, Esau comes out first. He is the oldest, but grabbing his heel along the way is Jacob. And that sets the stage for everything else that's going to happen in their lives. You fast forward, they're kind of growing up now. Esau's Jacob's the more domesticated of the two. Esau is kind of the hunter. He's described as being red and hairy. And I'm guessing if you describe somebody as hairy, they must have a lot of hair on them. You know, I'm guessing chest, arms, everything. You know, you've seen a few of those people. That is Esau. It's going to come back in the story here in just a minute. But one of the days, Esau comes home and he's hungry. And Jacob has got a pot of stew there. Esau wants some, and the conniving little Jacob says, no, you got to give me something. Eventually, what happens, Esau gives away his birthright to his brother Jacob over a pot of stew. You would think, how would Esau do that? Why don't he just go get some food somewhere else? That tells you something what he thought about his birthright at the moment. That tells you something about Jacob and what he's willing to do to his brother. Fast forward a little bit later, and now not only the birthright, but part of the firstborn, one of the things he has besides a birthright is a blessing. Now, Jacob and his mama, they connive to get the blessing stolen from Esau. When Esau is out on the day that this blessing is supposed to happen, he's going out and killing the game and trying to get the venison to bring back to his dad and fix it and prepare it so that his dad will then give him the blessing. Mama and Jacob connive this little thing where they got some meat and they go get some animal skins and they put it all over Jacob's arms and over his body and put a bunch of that animal scent on him so that when he comes into Isaac, who is mostly blind by now, can't see very well, when Jacob comes in pretending to be Isaac, he cannot help but think that this is Jacob because he hears Jacob's voice. But so he wants him to come over nearer, and when he does, he wants to feel his son because he knows Esau is hairy. And as he does, he feels the animal skins and the hair all, and I'm thinking, if he's convinced by the animal skins, this boy Esau must have really been hairy. I'm thinking, enough that he smelled like Esau, felt like Esau, even though his voice seemed like Jacob's. And Isaac gives him the blessing. A little bit later, Esau comes in with his prepared game, ready to get his blessing, only to find out that it had been given to his younger brother. And boy, is he mad. Fit to be tied. And if Mama doesn't intervene, maybe another Cain-Abel situation. I don't know. Mama sends Jacob off, and he goes back to the land from where Abraham came from, where some of her family still live. And they don't see each other for another 21 or so years. The next time they see each other, and maybe for the last time, Jacob has gone and worked for his uncle Laban, 7 years for one of his wives, another 7 years for the sister, another wife, and another 7 years. He's now collected some flocks, herds. His kids, some of the kids have been born and they're growing up. And then he's leaving and going to go back to the homeland. And as he does, he hears that Esau's on the way. Fear and panic come in Jacob's. He's not seen his brother, and the last he has, it's the things that he's stolen and the things that he's done to his brother. So he sends people ahead with gifts and different parts of his family ahead to Esau just to kind of mellow him out just in case. Esau's got a different mindset. And it is actually a good reunion, and they hug and embrace, but Jacob never trusts. He never thinks this is going to be good. Esau invites him back to his place and to go with him, and Jacob says, nope, I'm going to go my own direction. And I'm guessing that may be the last time they ever saw each other. That's where it started, the feud between the Israelites and the Edomites. It started with the two twin brothers who didn't know how to get along, couldn't take it, and over time, their descendants began to treat each other in a similar fashion. Time kind of helped that a little bit, for you see, Jacob, eventually, when Joseph is sold into slavery, they all end up making their way to Egypt. The Edomites grow in number and people, so do the Israelites in Egypt. They make their way back, and then here's what happens. The Edomites won't let them come through. They're afraid of the Israelites, their brothering nation. And then all through, when Saul was king and David was king and Jehoshaphat and Amaziah and all these other kings, the Edomites and the Israelites just can't get along, even though they're brother nations. They come from twin brothers, and they can't get along. Why is that? My guess is most of the people don't know. They just know, oh, you're an Israelite. I don't like you. Why? I don't know. You're an Israelite. Why don't you like him? He's a McCoy. I'm a Hatfield. I don't know. We don't like each other. Yeah. It's kind of a similar thing, you know. Oklahoma's mother married Texas's father, and now we're stepbrothers. And I've been trying to unhook them ever since. Yeah. But yesterday they put it to us. So, but you know, there are feuds that happen in this sibling rivalry, and it plays itself out. You guys kind of understand the sibling rivalry stuff if you've had brothers and sisters. It happens. In some dysfunctional families, it's even worse. I mean, we had it in our family, but we were fairly close. We were just highly competitive, always wanted to beat each other at anything. And most of the time, I won. And they will probably disregard that if you're watching. Sorry. Yeah. But in this particular chapter, Obadiah, through the Lord, is going to say, here's what's going to happen to you Edomites. And I'm going to start with verse 10, and I'm going to talk about the things that they did, and then I'll back it up. But it happens because of their prejudiced actions against their brother, their brothering nation, that they chose not to get along with. They could have. They saw how the Lord blessed them over and over again, and yet they wanted to have nothing to do with them. It's amazing what hate and pride and those kind of things can do once they get in. And these people, and in verse 10, it says this, because of violence to your brother Jacob, here's an interesting thing. The word violence there in Hebrew is Hamas. Thought that was interesting. You know, the modern day we hear Hamas a lot, and it's actually an acronym in Arabic for these different words, which really stand for the Islamic Resistance Movement, I think is what it says over into English. But it ends up being the same word. And the word there kind of comes with this idea of physical brutality and moral weakness. I don't know if there's any connections there, but I thought, as I saw that, I thought, to myself. But he goes on in verse 11 and he kind of lays out, here's four things that you have done that are causing your downfall. On the day, verse 11, that you stood aloof, on the day the strangers carried off his wealth, foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You stood by and you did nothing. When people came and the Assyrians had come in and the Babylonians had come in, Philistines at different times had come in, might think that, you know, in Psalms 137, during the Babylonian captivity, this is a psalm written during the captivity. In Psalm 137, 7, one of the things it says is, Lord, don't forget Edom who stood by when all these things happened. The Edomites, God is answering that prayer, but the Edomites just stood by and did nothing as these other people came in and carried off their wealth and took many of them away. in our world, sometimes we will see, and we get to see it on news, or we hear the stories where somebody was beat to death in the streets, and the people sat and watched from their windows or their cars, and nobody got involved. Nowadays, we have about 20 videos or more of the event while people take pictures, but afraid to get involved, afraid to stand in. They stood by while things happened. Verse 12, the other thing was, they gloated over their brother's day. They rejoiced when things happened. When bad things happen to somebody you don't like, how do you react? It's interesting, recently, you know, in the shooting of Charlie Kirk and in the news, and you know, there's such a hatred in our country, of, you know, along political lines, and not everybody does this, and not everybody who's on another side does this, but the fact that many people do, and that they can rejoice over that kind of massacre, that kind of shooting of another person, just because they think differently. And here, it's one of the things that contribute to their downfall. Verse 13 reminds us that they looted the wealth, that as things were carried off and as the people were carried out, what did they do? That they went in and grabbed some of the stuff themselves. I remember back decades ago when the riots in Los Angeles, people were going in, you know, and as many businesses get kind of windows broken out and broken into, my guess is a lot of the people who didn't break in, but also found an opportunity to come in and just take at someone else's expense. And they would just go out and loot. And we've seen that over the years in a variety of places, looting. And I thought of another situation. I've seen it with families that have circled like vultures over the dying of an unloved one. And I call it that. More often we talk about the person of our loved one that dies, but there are some people in our families that are the unloved ones. People that just can't wait for that person to die, grandma, grandpa, mom, dad, step, whoever. They don't care enough to be around them when they're alive. They don't want to come and see them and visit them or other. They're just waiting and circling because they know there might be some money or something to get. And so they're just hanging around. Sometimes we see it in movies, but you know what? It happens in real life. These first three things that are mentioned, it's kind of irony to me a little bit, because verse 10 says, because of the violence done to your brother, and I'm looking at these things, and they don't seem real violent. They seem kind of passive. It's kind of a passive thing. You stood aloof and did nothing. You rejoiced at what they were doing. You're happy that the Sooners got beat yesterday by Texas. Be careful if you were. I'm just saying, you know, yeah. No. But and then when everything was gone, you went in and got some of their possession. It seems very passive here. It doesn't seem very violent. But then they do get involved. Verse 14, and don't stand at the fork of the road. And it's written in such a way, and I will say this, the New American Standard writes it in such a way as, hey, don't do these things, don't do these things. Other versions will do it. It's because they have done these things. In the past, this is what they have done. And they said they stand at the fork of the road to cut down the fugitives and to imprison their survivors. They basically are helping the Babylonians or whoever it is that's coming and take him away. Any of the Israelites who try to escape, they're there to either kill or to imprison. They kind of help the enemies. It's kind of the cheap way out. It's kind of the sissy way out, a little bit, if you will. I feel like I've seen it this way, where people wait until somebody else starts it or wait until somebody's wounded, and then they kind of join in. Somebody else kind of knocked them down, and we're going to jump in, and we're going to start kicking them. Somebody else wounded them And I probably see it more often in the verbal sense. Somebody is beaten down and people come around and then just pile it on and add on. And we see that on the internet too much. People are really brave when they're behind a computer or behind a phone, anonymous. God says, because of these actions, you're going to become no more. But what was it that caused them to act like this? I think when you have such a hate in your heart towards other people and a pride of thinking only or primarily of yourself, and you care way more about yourself than you do the other people, it's often going to reveal itself in actions that aren't very nice and kind. And where it starts out in Obadiah basically talks about this prideful arrogance that they have. For you see, Edom lived in this rock fortress. There's going to be a picture, I believe, up on the screen here in just a minute. And in this fortress, it was called Selah, which meant in Hebrew, meant rock. Because this rock fortress was this red rock that was to get into the place. And I chose this picture because it's the only way in is this very narrow route to get to it. And the walls are very high. And then once you get in, then you've got this kind of little community city that's got other rock formations little places in where you could hide out in little caves in, and you can sleep in, and you can hang out in, and you can be protected. And the only way in is to get through there. And so they were in this protected place that they thought, hey, it's a great defense. God says to them, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of these rocks. You say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? And though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. You have this place that you think you can act a certain way towards all this and nobody can come and get you. And God says, I can. I can get there. And I can do it with people even. The place now is called Petra. It was called Selah, which meant rock in Hebrew. Eventually, the Nabataeans, and I'll get there in a minute, will kind of throw the Edomites out and run them off and kill many of them. And then a little bit later, the place becomes Petra because now the Greeks, everything's turning from the Greek empires. And Petra is the Greek word for rock. We've heard it before in some places. Some of you heard it because you know their music back in the 80s and the 90s, you know, the singing group Petra. Matthew 16, when Jesus says, hey, who do people say that I am? And the disciples, well, some people think that you're Elijah or John the Baptist or one of the prophets. And Peter kind of pipes up and says, well, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus' response was, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. In Greek it says, you are Petros, which means small stone, Peter. But upon this rock, Petra, which is a rock, a large rock, I will build my church. That very foundation of us recognizing that Jesus is the Messiah, that he's got the answers, that he has life eternal in him. That's the bedrock upon which we build our faith. But some rocks don't stand up as well as other rocks. These rocks, although it protected them, and for quite a while, God would find a way to take the Edomites and destroy them. their fortress caused them to think that they were invincible, that nobody could get to them. It caused them to think more of themselves. That's what pride does. Pride causes us to think that we are more than. Pride fuels our selfishness. Proverbs 16:18 says this, and you have heard this phrase, and you may have not known that it was Proverbs. Many of you would, and maybe you just said, oh, it's a phrase I've known. Proverbs 16:18 says this, pride goes before a fall. Happened with Satan, happened in the garden. Almost always before our falls, it's because of our pride. Our pride and our selfishness. And because of that, the Edomites eventually became no more. And we will see in the 4th century how the Nabataeans come in and they drive out the Edomites and they destroy many of them. And by the 2nd century, another group has kind of basically taken the Edomites and you don't find too many of them anymore. And there's kind of a remnant of them in that same area where the Edomites lived, south of, you know, south of the Dead Sea, south of where Judah and Israel were, was an area called Idumea. Some of the remnants of the Edomites were there. The most famous one was a man by the name of Herod the Great. Herod the Great, like his predecessors, his forefathers, tried to kill the king of the Jews. We know what happened there. Many of the other babies in Bethlehem were killed. Eventually, Herod goes on and Jesus lives until he ends up saving us and saving even what might have been remained of people of Edom. But by this time, they are no more. They are just stubble. They are no longer a nation. And God will prophesy in it that the Jacob and Joseph, those houses will come back, and they come back from captivity, and they begin to dwell in that land, but the Edomites are no more. What God says goes. We must be careful. We have heard in some of our prior sermons over the summer about this idea of loving God. Has this idea of meaning we got to love our brother. We got to love one another. Those two commands. My Sunday school class that's meeting right now, or I say mine, the one I used to be in, I'm not in very much anymore, but they're in 1 John chapters 3 and 4. And John will kind of point this out, is that, you know what, you can't say you love God and you hate your brother. Things that we have to continue to work on. As we wind down this sermon, I want you to imagine something with me. I want you to imagine a throne. And the one on the throne is the one who calls the shots, dictates the rules, determines what is right. Now imagine that throne is kind of over your heart. And here's the question. Who sits on that throne? Now, I know many of us would probably say, we just sang about the Lamb being upon his throne. Jesus having a crown. One that went from a crown of thorns to a royal crown. And as Christians, we have Jesus on that throne. There's a problem, though. If we're not, we're on that throne. Proverbs also says this. There are 7 things God hates. The first on that list is pride. I don't know if there's a reason that pride is listed first. But I think pride is one of the beginnings of most all sins. It's the thing that fuels the selfishness. It's the thing that puts ourselves first among God. And here's, I have this question. Why does God hate pride so much? And I think it's this. I think it's that when we're full of pride, that we've put ourselves up on that throne. And when we're on the throne, and he is not, it's a whole lot harder for God to use us and to God to do things and to mold us and to shape us into what we need to be, is because it's hard to use somebody who's hard-hearted, who is selfish, and it's all about them. It takes a humble heart to have Jesus take over your life. Peter will say these words: God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. When we say we're about real grace, it first starts with the grace that we get from God. It takes us humbling our hearts and allowing that grace to extend to us. And I pray that your heart always has Jesus on that throne, and that sometimes we have to battle of trying to put ourselves there. We might have done that once, but we have to constantly quit trying to take him off the throne and putting ourselves there. Selfishness will continue to get in the way if we let it. Let me pray. Father, forgive us when we are selfish, when pride rears its ugly head and gets in the way. Because sometimes when it does, we forget how to act towards you and towards our fellow brothers and sisters. Lord, may we humble ourselves before you and allow you to lift us up. And we rest in this, that you give grace to the humble. So, Father, forgive us when that pride just takes a hold. And I pray for some here that maybe that's part of the thing they've been wrestling with for too long. It's they want what they want and not what you want. And Lord, that is so easy to do so often because we get so selfish. So today, help us one step at a time to keep putting you first, loving you with our whole heart, and loving our brothers and sisters. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.